Hey everybody, welcome to Two Off the First. It's May 15th, 2024. I'm Ryan Ballinger. Thanks for being here. Talking about a couple of things today. We're going to try to focus as much as we can on the PIF, PGA Tour, LIV stuff, as well as a little bit from Scottie Scheffler about his layoff. We will talk for a few minutes here at the Open about Rory McIlroy filing for divorce from his wife. I don't want to spend too much time on it because, I mean, these are people's lives, right? And it's their personal lives. I have no idea what went into the situation between Rory McIlroy and Erica Stoll. They also have a daughter, Poppy, who's, you know, 3. Obviously, she's never going to listen to this. But I still feel it's very important to kind of have some respect and perhaps empathy for the situation. Anyone's going through this kind of thing. I don't like the idea of dancing around and, you know, carrying a smirk on your face when stuff like this happens. But it did happen, and we did a video on it for MSN and YouTube and stuff like that, and someone commented, who cares? And to a degree, that person is right. Who cares? Some of you listening may, but most people don't know Rory McIlroy personally. I talked to him for maybe a couple seconds ever. Seems like a nice guy, but I don't know him. I don't know what kind of person he is in reality. And just like most people don't know who I am in reality, good, bad, or indifferent. So I don't want to talk about McIlroy like I know him. I don't have a parasocial relationship with him. I enjoy watching him play golf. That's kind of the extent of it. But I don't know him personally. All I know is that he filed for divorce on May 13th in Palm Beach County Court, family court. The filings have been made. It costs $419 to file. McIlroy's lawyer is the same lawyer that Tiger Woods used in his divorce proceedings 15 years ago. And that is kind of it. You know, the filing basically says their marriage is irretrievably broken. That's something you kind of have to say in these proceedings. You can't go, well, I just want a divorce. I don't want to be around this person anymore. That's not how that works. You got to check a box on a form to say why you are seeking a divorce or dissolution of marriage in terms of legal terminology. And they have different categories for it and all that stuff and whatever. So I think the reaction, and this is really more why I want to talk about the reaction to it. So TMZ Sports found out about it, and they find about these kinds of things because they are willing to pay off people at courts, you know, who handle these types of things. People who might see the documentation come in. It's not like they're sitting there all day like, searching for that. Like they get tipped off to it, and there's probably a spiff there, and that's how they handle things, and that's how they get stories. That's their business model. That's okay. But when that got out there, it seemed like some folks kind of assumed that this is just something that happens. Like up in one day, you decide to file for divorce. And that is definitely not the case. I'm not a product of divorce. I've never been around that kind of thing in my family directly, fortunately. But I also know lots of people have been through that kind of thing, either personally or because of their parents or someone very close to them. This kind of stuff doesn't happen overnight. This is something that boils over in months or years. And eventually, one or both parties reach the breaking point, and one decides, or they mutually decide, that's it. And that's what leads to a court filing. That's what leads you to go to the courthouse and sign those papers and have an attorney and have all this stuff drawn up. And they had a prenuptial agreement. And all these types of things, like all of that stuff, those were likely conversations that happened with his attorney over months, if not longer. And that leads you to believe that there have been problems for a while. And I think some folks noticed when McIlroy won at the Wells Fargo, I was getting ready to go up to New Jersey for the ShopRite Media LPGA Classic Media Day. So I did not catch this piece, but I did see it after the fact. McIlroy didn't mention his wife, soon to be former wife, I suppose, in his comments to Amanda Baliones after winning the tournament. He talked about his own mom, which, hey, I mean, you're asked to talk about Mother's Day, talk about your mom. But at the same time, I think normal circumstances, you give credit to your spouse for being a great mother to your child or children or whatever. So, and the intrigue of that is there are so many people searching the internet right now to try to figure out if Amanda Baliones is still married. Or you know, she's not going by Amanda Renner or whatever. Again, up to her to figure out how she wants to talk about that, if there's anything to it. But people were reading into McElroy's comments, and then turns out, yeah, filing happened on the day after the Wells Fargo. Now, he talked today, and I think it's ongoing right now at Valhalla as we're recording this. I tend to not watch news conferences live just because they're just kind of drip, drip, drip. And yeah, I want a fuller context with more time to kind of digest it and then maybe watch it after the fact. But apparently, reporters were apprised that he would not answer questions about his personal life, about his divorce filing, anything like that. Which, he hasn't really put out a statement about this personally. They haven't done a joint statement, anything like that. A guy that I know is a biographer who's working on a book about McElroy was very taken aback by the fact that there was no joint statement and that McElroy chose to file this individually without doing it jointly, and that obviously he has Tiger Woods' divorce attorney on retainer or whatever. That seemed to bother him that, you know, maybe there's probably more to this than we will ever understand, but whatever that looks like. And I don't know what that means beyond that happened, right? If you're someone who bets on sports, if you bet on golf, you wonder what does that mean for McElroy's performance. If you have that kind of parasocial relationship with him or you're a fan of his, maybe you wonder how that affects him personally and professionally. My base instinct is to think, what does this mean for these three people's lives? Not only Erica and Rory, but also Poppy, their daughter, and more importantly, her, the daughter, because that's a life-changing event, and she didn't sign up for it. It wasn't her fault. She didn't do anything wrong, and that could have dramatic consequences for her life. So whatever it means for him competitively, we could talk about that on the Golf Betting Podcast, and that's fine. And I don't know how the public will react to it. I know there's a lot of conversation about it at Valhalla, I'm sure, and among fans online, I'm sure. I don't know what that all really amounts to, other than this guy made this decision in his life for whatever reason. One, he's probably never going to share publicly, and felt that was his only solution. That's a hard place to be in life. Really hard place to be in life. So leave it at that, I suppose. I'd like to talk about some comments John Rahm made yesterday. I think that was going to be my bigger piece of this show until, you know, everything happened with McElroy, and I felt like we should at least address that for a few minutes. So John Rahm is talking yesterday, and Tiger Woods talked yesterday, so we'll maybe lump some of that in too because it's similar topic. And Rahm is asked about all things happening with the PGA Tour and the Saudi negotiations, and he was pretty adamant a couple of different times in his news conference to say, this is not a two-other side thing. I'm not on the other side of the PGA Tour because he's still a PGA Tour member. He hasn't resigned his membership, albeit a suspended one, and facing financial penalty for being a tour member. He's also still a DP World Tour member. He hasn't resigned those memberships. And so he banged the gavel and said, you know, I may play my golf on LIV, but I still am a PGA Tour member. And he used the word, I still want to support the PGA Tour. And what he means by that really is he wants to play the tournaments he wants to play. And he emphasized that again at Valhalla, that had he been afforded the opportunity to defend the couple of titles that he won or to go play Phoenix, you know, those types of things, the tournaments he wants to play, he would have played those tournaments in addition to the LIV Golf requirement that he has to play all 14 of their tournaments. And that he remains hopeful that there is a deal that allows something like a world tour to take shape, where you have kind of elite level players competing around the world and they play in these bigger tournaments. And those are kind of my biggest takeaways from what he said. He got into some other stuff as well, namely that he doesn't care how long it takes. He wants whatever a deal looks like to be correct. And I do want to touch on that too, because I think that's an interesting perspective. It's a naive one, really, but it's an interesting perspective. So maybe start with that, because I don't think there's a right deal here. This isn't a willing coming together here. This is a forced coming together here, in part because of what Jimmy Dunn, Ed Herlihy, and Jay Monahan negotiated with Yasser Al-Rumayyan, right? The three people on the PGA Tour side of the table really didn't or shouldn't have had, didn't have, perhaps, the capacity to properly represent their constituents, because the players weren't represented at all in the negotiation. The goal for Dunn, Herlihy, and Monahan was to end their lawsuits, save the tour money and legal fees, and perhaps put them in a position to work with the Saudis as investors while eliminating LIV Golf. That was their goal. No player was consulted on any of that, right? On the Saudi side, Al-Rumayyan wants to be involved in golf. He wants to be seen as important in professional golf. He doesn't really care how. However, he has also invested billions of his country's sovereign wealth into developing a professional golf tour that is just lighting money on fire, not making anything back, and not drawing any kind of significant viewership. So they come to the table because of this kind of, illegitimate, but a negotiation that really probably wouldn't have happened were it not for Jimmy Dunn and Ed Herlihy, specifically Jimmy Dunn. And that's why he's kind of puffing his chest out on the way out the door from the board. So you get to this conversation of, I hope it's from Ramov, I hope it's the right deal. I don't care if it takes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years to get there. I want the right deal made. Well, the right deal is very different with whatever that is between the negotiating sides. And for the people on the PGA Tour policy board, what looks good is probably different. I don't know that Greg Norman may feel exactly the same as Al-Rumayyan as what a good deal is. MBS may have a different view than Al-Rumayyan, right? Those are kind of the three people that matter on their side, I suppose, of that table. And I think Rahm comes at very naively to say, well, I want him to get the deal right. No, that's not how this is going to work. There's going to be some winning and some losing. And who does the most losing and who does the most winning, I suppose, remains to be seen. But at the same time, I question how much the PGA Tour can win, because they don't have the money. They have some investment, but that investment would actually kind of like to have the Saudis on board. And by kind of, I mean really. They have been losing players and fans, and they really aren't in a position to command a whole lot and hope that they get what they really want, which is for LIV Golf to go away. And I don't even know if they can get that, if that's, what an ideal deal looks like. But in the perfect world, that's what their right deal is. LIV goes away, Saudis invest, PGA Tour is the big brand again, and there's no muddiness of that water. For the Saudis, they're hoping for something very different. What a right deal to them looks like is LIV Golf stays, the franchises are somehow worth something, for their teams, even though they're not. And they have an outsized influence using the PGA Tour as leverage or a siren song to bring in business to their country as a form of economic development. Those sound very unaligned. The very unaligned. How do you get them to be right for everybody? So that's not going to happen. So not John Rahm's not understanding what's happening here. However, I thought it was, to go to the next point, I thought it was really interesting. Aaron Oberholzer got very upset about what Rahm said. And I think he has a right to, because this is something that has come up repeatedly from LIV players. They want their cake and to eat it too. They want to be able to collect all the money they've collected from signing with LIV Golf, and they made that choice. But they also want to cherry pick and play the PGA Tour whenever they feel like it. So they want the benefits of being in a closed contract-based system and then to be able to float and go play wherever else, versus a PGA Tour player who's not signed to LIV does not have that opportunity. They can't just go and say, hey, I'd love to jump into this next LIV event and go play three of these or whatever. That's not an option for them. So it's not an apples-to-apples opportunity for PGA Tour players and LIV players, right? And you know, Bryson loves to throw out this idea that PGA Tour players used to be seen as independent contractors, and they could just go play anywhere at any time. And that is a load of shit. Just like Jordan Spieth triple emphasized in his pre-tournament news conference, that it's a load of shit that the PGA Tour is a player-run organization. It is a member-based organization. It is not a player-run organization. And it has not been for a long, long time. And now they are in a position, because they control the board with more players than independent directors, that they sort of have control. I mean, technically they do in terms of votes, but the money has the control. And that's what he's saying. It's now more balanced. The money has a stake. The players have a stake. Players have more votes. The money has the money. That's that. So for Bryson to come out and say, well, used to be able to be an independent, you were never an independent contractor. No PGA Tour player was ever an independent contractor. Now, DP World Tour players are about as close as it gets to independent contractors, because the DP World Tour has to let them do that for them to remain members, to be relevant to the Ryder Cup. They don't really have a lot. They have next to zero leverage, right? Except the Ryder Cup, which is why it's very important you remain a DP World Tour member. It's a must to be on the Ryder Cup team for the European side. That is their one and only leverage point. They use it. The PGA Tour was never an independent contractor thing. You are a member of an organization. Do you wish to remain a member of the organization? Then you need to do the following things. You need to play in at least 7 tournaments a year to have voting rights. You need to play in at least 15 tournaments a year to have voting privileges or full membership. You know, there's different stipulations. You have to sign over your likeness rights, you know, basically NIL rights to the PGA Tour for their use, for pulling everything together. Otherwise, it'd be really weird to distribute it otherwise, because you'd be individual negotiations, which is something Phil likes to obfuscate and doesn't really understand, apparently. So there's that. And the PGA Tour always could say, and has always written into their agreements with players, you have to follow our guidelines. And our guidelines include when you can and cannot play in our tour. And for example, when you have an opposite field event, take the Myrtle Beach event and Wells Fargo last week. If you are qualified for the Wells Fargo, the regulations say you can't sign up for the Myrtle Beach Classic, even though you're technically eligible. You either play in the Wells Fargo or you don't play at all. That's a regulation. That's a rule. That's a rule about which PGA Tour events you can play, right? They also tell you which PGA Tour events you can play. Oh, you didn't get in the top 70 in the FedEx Cup? Then you cannot play the FedEx St. Jude Championship. You can't just show up and say, I'm going to play this week. Where's the first team? What's the course record? That's not an option. Just the same way you can't just go and play any DP World Tour event. You can't go play any LIV Golf event, Asian Tour event, PGA Tour of Australasia event. You can't just go and play those if there is a competing PGA Tour event, unless you get what's called a competing event release. That has been the case for the entire time that I've ever covered the PGA Tour. So all the players from LIV who kind of pull out this card are going, we were independent contractors. No, you never were and you never will be. You aren't with LIV and you weren't with the PGA Tour. So the players on LIV have this notion that they want to be able to do both, but they don't want the PGA Tour players to have that opportunity. I promise you, Ian Poulter would not be thrilled with the idea of a totally fluid LIV golf field. Lee Westwood would not either. He's made something like $700,000 this year being the worst golfer on LIV. He would be absolutely upset if they said, hey, you know, Lee, you haven't been very good this year. We'd love to have Tom Kim come in instead and just play out the rest of the season. That wouldn't be fun for him, but he's got that opportunity now. So all of this stuff, no one's winning. Everyone's losing. And it feels like most people involved in this process have a poor understanding of what's happening here. And it makes me reluctant enough to say that I think the only guy who knows he's got leverage and he's got that calculation correct is Al Ramayan. You don't have to like it, and I don't. But he's the only guy here who has true leverage because he's got all the money in the world to spend, and he can choose A or B. He can spend it on LIV, or he can spend it on the PGA Tour. And that decision alone has consequences. Everyone else really doesn't have a whole lot of leverage. So what that all looks like in negotiations and boardrooms, I don't know. John Rahm doesn't know. Rory McIlroy apparently is not going to know at the policy board level, but we'll know on the transaction subcommittee level. And what all that takes the shape of, who knows? We'll see. But I do find it fascinating that Rahm is kind of in that camp of guys who would just love to have exactly what they want to do codified for them and allow them to make their money beating, you know, 9 other good players on the LIV Tour. And then, hey, I love the Phoenix Open. Let's go play for, you know, $1.5 million out there. It just boggles my mind. And it shouldn't, because a lot of the people who are talking on the player side, they've never run a business, will never truly run a business. They'll run a business about as big as mine in terms of employees, right? You might have a caddy, a nutritionist, an instructor, a travel agent, I don't know, whatever, posse. But that's a small business of 6 maybe employees max, right? And they're asked their thoughts on an enterprise that on the PGA Tour side is worth billions, and on the PIF side is worth darn close to $1 trillion. It's a different ball game than what the PGA Tour players understand. And that alone makes this a super strange, interesting story, which is why we keep following it. I do want to talk about Scottie Scheffler for just a few seconds. Great to have him back. He's adamant there's no rust. He's been working on his game these last few weeks, that he is going to miss, you know, being around his son, being around their child when he goes away for tournaments. And actually, that might make him an even more disciplined player in a way. I almost think of Scottie Scheffler as the modern Billy Casper. And Billy Casper won a boatload of golf tournaments. And Scheffler, I think, is grounded enough to understand that he needs to be more efficient with his time now, right? But ultimately, he's also in a position where he's made $100 million playing golf. He can hire whatever help he needs to make his life easier. And I'm sure he has a very genuine interest in wanting to be an actively engaged parent along with his wife. But they're going to strike that balance. And I think they probably had long conversations about what that looks like, and now have a plan in place to try the best they can to make that a good balance. We'll see what happens. But glad to have him back this week. That's going to do it for us today on the show. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate it. Back tomorrow with another one. We'll talk a little bit about Valhalla. Talk a little bit about the future of the PGA Championship. And we'll see what kind of comes out of the remaining news conferences for today. But everything gets underway tomorrow. Start nice and bright and early. Michael Block's kicking us off. I'm sure there'll be plenty of Michael Block stuff going on tomorrow and Friday in the event that he doesn't make the cut again. It'll be a great week. So hopefully you enjoy everything. Even if you're, you know, back to work at this point in your life and don't get to watch as much Thursday, Friday type of stuff, but we'll be here to talk about it all with you as well. Email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com if you want to get a hold of me. Twitter, Threads, X, Instagram, and Blue Sky @RyanBallenge. Facebook and YouTube, Ryan Ballenge Golf. Subscribe to us on YouTube @GolfNewsNet. Just search to us there. We're starting to put out daily videos there. A lot of the stuff that we distribute otherwise, but it's all kind of headline-driven, short, 2 to 3 minute type videos that are easy to consume, catch up on things, just kind of like this show. Easy to catch up on something. This is a little more in depth than we do in a 2 or 3 minute video, but something that's easy to consume and kind of keep you in touch with the bigger headlines of the game and not just the PIF, PGA Tour, LIV stuff, like everything. So check that out on YouTube. Thanks again for listening. We will talk to you tomorrow on 2 Off the First.